Accession number 27347, Reel 4.
Stanley Brown, Reel 4. You were just telling me, obviously, about the work that you did to improvise on railway trucks again. Could you just give me a description of what you actually did on those railway trucks and what the plating was and the thickness and various details like that?
The trucks we used were just ordinary four-wheeled general goods trucks. They were about inside. They were probably about 15 feet long, something of that order. 6, 12, maybe it's 18 feet long. And the sides were about 3 feet deep. We didn't want the very high-sided trucks because we would have been very we would have found it difficult to take a rifle or a Lewis gun over the top. All we did was line the two sides, the long sides, with plate as thick as we could scrounge, and the two ends again we wanted those armoured in case we were the rear one, because we felt that a lot of the shooting would come at us against the end, that maybe get to the railway line from a crossing, so they'd be standing between the rails shooting at us after we'd gone past. So the ends were even more important than the sides. It was just a case of lining them with whatever we could get. Sometimes we had a 2 foot plate which would cover us if we were lying down in the bottom. We just had to take what we could get, because steel was so scarce for the shipyard. They couldn't cut it to our requirements because there wasn't enough available. They were building corvettes and frigates.
You indicated that there was an awful lot of improvisation going on within the units.
Yes.
Is there a reason for that?
Just that official supplies were not available. In fact, we couldn't get hold of as many bayonets as we wanted for the broom shanks that we were wiring to, and we actually used cleavers from the butcher. When we ran out of bayonets, we used cleavers. On the principle that if you could get a slash at somebody like that, he might be too close to you to for him to use a gun. We hoped.
It sounds like there's an awful lot of skills, though, that existed within the unit.
Well,
as well,
there were a cross section of humanity. We had bakers who used to bring loaves of bread down when we were on nights, which you couldn't get just by queuing up the bakers, but he knew he was on the inside. You've seen Dad's Army. The local butcher could do all sorts of things. You know, my dad would never accept one thing extra over and above the ration. He would have made Mother take it back. And in fact, it's passed down the generations. My son was born in 1943, and my wife was in hospital a long time because she had placenta previa, which caused a hemorrhage, and she had to stay in hospital for about 6 months. she'd handed her ration books in, knowing she was going into hospital. When eventually she came out of hospital and got her ration book back, the butcher gave her some extra butter, and I made her take it back. Dad would have had fits if I'd accepted it, but it was so drummed into us as a family. Get your ration and be thankful for it. Don't be satisfied with anything less than your ration. But black marketeers were beyond the pale. I want to divert and tell some other stories about Dad. When I was about 5 or 6, my father was working in the dockyard, and he'd had been getting castings which had blowholes in them, and the way to doctor those up, if the blowholes weren't important, was to fill the blowhole with a mixture of iron filings and sal ammoniac, which expanded in the cavity and filled it. That's all right, providing they're in places that don't matter. But blowholes in the walls of a cylinder were untenable. My father had been rejecting supplies of castings from a particular supplier. And on Christmas Eve, Dad was still at work because he had to lock up the fitting shop at Smith's Docks. On Christmas Eve, there was a knock at the door, and a man appeared with a turkey, which he gave to Mother. And we'd never seen a turkey in all our life. And as soon as Dad did come home, which was about 10 o'clock at night, 10:30, Dad, come see this, the turkey. And he looked very cross, and I couldn't understand why. And he looked at the label, and he took the turkey, and he hung it on his handlebars, and he cycled off, and he returned that turkey to the man at the casting suppliers. He wasn't going to be given any presents by people he had to return faulty material to. That was one lesson. Another lesson was when I was doing homework when I was about 12 years old, I needed a pencil because I'd broken my pencil and then sharpened it and found that the lead broke every time that I sharpened to the point. So I went to Dad's waistcoat, which was hanging underneath the hot water tank, and took a pencil out of his waistcoat pocket and used it, and forgot to put it back. And I got a right old dressing down for that. If it had been his pencil, fine, he would always share it with me and I needn't ask for it. But it wasn't his pencil, it was Smith Dot's pencil, and by taking it, it was theft. So I had some lessons when I was a youngster.
You're saying obviously as well that there was a level of skills though within the unit that you said bakers and butchers and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Would they supply the unit though at that stage with bits and pieces?
They tried to. They were limited with what they could do. I remember getting fresh bread, and it was the dark grey bread that all ration bread was made out of. It was just that that was before the days of bread rationing. I don't remember it ever happening after bread rationing, because there would have been, by some people, they would have been pestered for more, and other people, they would have been blackballed for it, being beyond the pale.
But the unit would have all the skills to plating and welding and that sort of thing.
Yes, we had platers, welders, electricians, plumbers, joiners. We had everything there, everything imaginable. The sort of crowd that later on in life I would have loved to have had with me at sea, because it could turn the hand to anything and make something out of nothing.
You mentioned the improvised bayonets. Did you do bayonet practice at all?
Oh, yes. Yes. With all the appropriate shouts and screams and gritting of teeth. And
how were you instructed to do that? What were you supposed to do with a bayonet?
You're supposed to put it in, try to twist it, and then twist it the opposite way to withdraw it, to put your foot on the victim.
Was there a lot of emphasis on bayonet practice?
There was, yes. Yes. I think it was a relic of Boer War rather than First World War. The volunteers that went out to Africa in the Boer War were fighting natives. There was more hand-to-hand than in the Second War. The only time, really, that the bayonet came into its own in the Second World War was when they went over the top. And even then, I think when it came to the enemy's trench, shooting was more appropriate than the bayonet.
But that had still hung over to the point where you were training.
Oh, yes. Because the people who were training us were First World War veterans. And in fact, we did have one who was a Boer War veteran. Just like, what's the name of the man in Dad's army?
Is it Corporal Jones?
Corporal Jones, yes. This chap wasn't quite a Corporal Jones. He was more down to earth and more practical.
You've mentioned Dad's army. How much did that television programme reflect your experiences of the Home Guard, would you say?
Oh, it was there. It was it was so true. Except that we didn't have Captain Mannering. The man we had was down to earth, and I would have been glad to follow him anywhere. If we had been invaded, I would have followed him to the end.
You touched on the ethos that you had about if you'd potentially been in action with the Home Guard. How well do you think the unit would have performed against regular German forces?
We would have been massacred. I mean, first of all, they were prepared to lean out of a bedroom window and light a match, light a piece of rag in the neck of a bottle and throw it into a tank. How long would they have survived that? We didn't have training in house-to-house fighting. And we would have had more house-to-house fighting than anything else, I think. And Jerry was good at it. He'd had lots of experience in Spain, in France. We would have been children to his experts.
You mentioned, obviously, the construction of the Molotov cocktails.
Yeah.
Was there anything else that was improvised? Any other weapons within the unit?
Only the armoured truck, the Lewis gun mounting, anti-aircraft mounting, we had a motorbike and sidecar as well, and we made a mounting for the Lewis gun on the front of the sidecar. heaven help the poor driver. But
how was that intended to be used?
I suppose it was self-defense. If you were committed to driving along a road and you met enemy units coming towards you, that it was a hope that you might get through if you could open fire. Mind, we would have probably blocked the road if we had open fire, and we'd made people desert their transport. The road would be blocked with their transport. We wouldn't have survived.
You've obviously mentioned the drill that you did.
Yeah.
The evening drill. But was there any other form of training that you undertook?
Oh, yes, we had field training. In fact, we had, once a year, we had a camp up on the moors where we did field training right through the night, which was good because it taught us that communication was of paramount importance, and that it was a thing that broke down so easily. Communication was, we didn't have any wireless, everything had to be done with runners, word of mouth, and unless you wrote it down, it would be misinterpreted. You've heard of the old story. We're advancing, send reinforcement, we're going to a dance, send us 3 4
And in these night exercises, would you have an enemy who was opposing you?
Yes, regulars. We hope to learn from them, and we hope that they might learn from us if ever they landed in France.
And how did that work out?
I think we did learn a lot from them. We learned that there comes a time when you've all got to break off for a cup of tea. Practically, compared with the real thing, we were so removed from the real thing that we were trying hard. It was really a sop, so that men would go in and do what they could, even if it meant giving their lives. It was a sop to the real thing. It made men feel that there was something useful they could do. And let's face it, if a man had a couple of sons away in the forces, and he had a job to do as well, he was feeling so impotent that anything he could do to make him feel better about himself was good for morale. The Home Guard was really a civilian Home Guard builder, civilian morale builder. That was its prime function, I think.
To that level, then, what type of tactics would you employ within the unit?
As I said before, we knew where the weak spots were in the marshalling yard and the docks, and I learned how to operate the dock gates. We would have done something, we would have achieved something, but nothing that was permanent. We couldn't have defeated them. All we could do was delay them. And they'd be delayed by good intentions rather than achievements.
When you were doing the exercises, to what kind of degree, though, would you be doing fieldcraft and that sort of thing, or tactical attack?
We were learning something from the old hands. But if it had come to the house-to-house struggle, we didn't know anything. We would just be gunfodder.
Later, obviously once you'd received some uniforms and some equipment, did you practice with hand grenades at all?
Oh yes, yes. Yes, and there were quite a few accidents as well. People panicking and dropping them. And the old hands going for them and trying to lob them out before the 5 seconds or 6 seconds were up. Yes, we got through a lot of hand grenades, in fact. There was one thing that did come forward quite plentiful at one time. And again, I had 2 cases of hand grenades under my floorboard.
How were you instructed? How do you to throw a hand grenade? How do you throw a hand grenade?
Oh, dear. My memory. First of all, secure your footing. Because if you're not securely poised, if there are any loose things around, sooner or later you're going to trip over one of them and the hand grenade that's in your hand is going to go rolling. That was the first lesson. I think the second lesson was, if you know what you're doing, don't be afraid of it. And having the knowledge of getting your footing right, making sure that there was no impediment to your arm swing, nobody standing behind you, no riveting or anything that you could that could distract you. Distraction was the thing, that if your hand met something, you were likely to drop the hand grenade. So you had to make sure everything was clear behind you as well as in front. The other thing was not to aim for too low a trajectory, because if you did and you let go just a shade too late, it would land down there instead of 15 yards in front of you. And the last lesson was that if you're throwing hand grenades at somebody, they're going to try and be throwing them at you too. So what sort of hand grenades are likely to come over? And the old potato masher type of hand grenade. And don't try and pick it up and throw it back at him. Otherwise you'll end up without an arm and maybe with a gut full of metal. No, the thing to do was take cover.
So, what do you actually do with the hand grenade itself?
You clinch the lever. And the way to do that is clinch it with your fingers, not with the palm. You clinch the lever. You pull out the pin. But for God's sake, don't throw the pin away. Hold it in case you have to put it back. Oh, it's taxing my memory now.
What type of setting would you have on it to time talk to?
Well, there were different types of fuses, but to alter the setting, you had to take the plug out and put a different fuse in. I always went for the 6-second fuse. A lot of people wanted the longer fuse, 10-second fuse, but to me that gave the opposition a chance to chuck it back at you. My attitude was get rid as quickly as you can with a short fuse so that it doesn't come back to you.
And how powerful would the explosion be from a hand grenade?
Oh. I wouldn't have liked to have been within 10 yards of one going off. Here to the end of the greenhouse, the conservatory. I wouldn't like to be closer than that to a hand grenade.
Did you enjoy your training with the Home Guard?
I felt it was a means to an end. I used to feel annoyed at the time that was wasted in forming fours, and I would have liked more instruction on sentry go, how to cover a duty to prevent anybody else getting to the thing you were guarding, but making yourself inconspicuous. I mean, the Home Guard used to teach me to march backwards and forwards. So obvious to anybody who wanted to come up and get into the station master's locker. They could get in so easily if a man was doing a regular patrol up and down. It was nonsensical. But that's what the army taught. And it was, well, in my book I criticised the Admiralty, but in the Home Guard I criticised the War Office.
How useful for it when you went on to your naval career? How useful was it?
The only way it was useful was it taught me how to deal with bullshit. Pardon the French. You can't let that go through, of course.